Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. To learn more about Allowed and learn how you can help the Library Foundation of Los Angeles support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The Allowed program you're about to hear was produced in 2009. Tonight it will be a conversation between Nicholson Baker and David L. Yulin, and after they talk, they will open it up to you for questions. We just ask that you wait until the microphone comes around to you, as we do record for podcast. And afterwards, Mr. Baker will be signing his book in the lobby. And the books are for sale tonight, courtesy of the library store. So again, if you purchase your book here, you are supporting the library and these programs. Nicholson Baker is the author of 8 novels, The Mezzanine, which takes place on an escalator, Vox, an inventive erotic novel, which transcribes a deliriously imaginative phone sex marathon, Room Temperature, The Fermata, the tale of an office worker who can stop time and uses his powers to undress women, The Everlasting Story of Nori, A Box of Matches, Checkpoint, and now The Anthologist, as well as 4 works of nonfiction, You and I, The Size of Thoughts, Human Smoke, and Double Fold. His essays have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, The New York Review of Books, and many other publications, and in 1999, he established a nonprofit corporation, the American Newspaper Repository, to rescue old newspapers from destruction by libraries. He is the recipient of the 2001 National Book Critics Circle Award for Double Fold and the San Francisco-based James Madison Freedom of Information Award in recognition of his newspaper preservation work. The New York Times book critic wrote in that paper that Baker's new novel, The Anthologist, is startlingly perceptive and ardent, both as a work of fiction and as a representation of the kind of thinking poetry readers do. Baker is a beautiful writer and a bracing reader of poetry. For the LA Times and her wonderful feature, writer Susan Reynolds visited Baker in Maine, and she filled in a few biographical details. How Nicholson Baker started writing full-time after a brief interlude as a financial analyst stockbroker on Wall Street. He said he sold one stock to his ex-bassoon teacher. Reynolds writes, he has always been a defender of the unsung in literature, the discarded, the small, subtle idea. And she ended with a quote from him saying, if I had to pick one thing that all my books are about, it's that a single human being can think about a lot of things. So to discuss a lot of things with Nicholson Baker tonight is David L. Yulin, book editor for the LA Times. David is the author himself of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith, and the editor of, among other books, Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, and Writing Los Angeles, a Literary Anthology, which won a California Book Award. We depend on him to keep us informed about the world of books and the world of writing. It is a great pleasure to introduce both Nicholson Baker and David L. Yulin to the library. Thank you.
Thanks. I woke up at about 2 a.m. in Manhattan this morning, so if I lose my lucidity or become incoherent, I'm hoping that Nick will pick up the slack. I wanted to start, there are a lot of ways we could start. So I'm going to offer you 2 starting questions and you can answer. I should also just parenthetically say thank you for the mezzanine, because in 15 years of teaching, every time a student of mine has said, I have nothing to write about, I make them read The Mezzanine.
Thank you.
But the 2 questions that I would start with are your thoughts on being in a library, given the librarian's reaction to Double Fold, and I think a kind of unfair reaction to Double Fold. And also, iambic pentameter? Let's talk about it. I'm curious. I want to talk about, so much of this new book is about iambic pentameter. And I think that a successful novel about iambic pentameter is a rare and wonderful thing.
So. Well, right. Iambic pentameter in the library. I'm thrilled to be in. I love libraries, and I started writing about them a long time ago when I learned that the card catalog in my own college library, which was Haverford, was on the loading dock, being kind of broken up and thrown out, or I guess it was hidden away. One of the odd things was when they made the decision to replace the card catalog with the electronic catalog, they sometimes just retired it, which meant they moved it to a secret place, and that would have been perfect because, you know, the electronic catalog is a lovely thing, and what you want is just to keep this big wooden machine somewhere as a snapshot of what was available to people of a certain time. So I learned that, and I wrote this impassioned piece back in, I guess it was 1993, about card catalogs, and that made me, I guess I had the library beat after that, and I wrote about the fact that the San Francisco Public Library had sent this 250,000 books to a landfill, and I used injudiciously harsh language, and I actually sued the San Francisco Public Library to release the records of the, and that was wrong. And what else did I do that was wrong? And then I wrote Double Fold, and that was a book that was about the fact that libraries were, at that point, very excited about microfilm. They'd gotten a lot of federal money, $100 million in federal money to take little pictures of things on plastic, and that's good. But they decided that because you have the pictures that you should not have the originals. And I was upset because the originals were so beautiful, and they were big, and they were newspapers, and they were published by Joseph Pulitzer and Hearst and other people, and they were filled with color, and they were extraordinary. And so I wrote Double Fold about that. And there was a moment, maybe 10 minutes, when I think librarians were very unhappy with me because they thought that I was criticizing what they were doing. But I was criticizing what one small minority of them were doing. I was criticizing a distortion of what they knew to be their true task, which is the keeping of what human beings publish. And it seems to me that that's why we're here. We're here in this beautiful building, extraordinarily beautiful building, because we know that some institution has to keep what human beings publish. Some fail-safe institution has to hold on to it. And if we decide 3 Tuesdays from now that everything is published electronically, then the institution has to keep what we publish electronically. We want to keep it in the form that it was published. And so now I get along very well with librarians. And I actually was an amateur librarian my wife and I had this large collection of newspapers that we got from the British Library, and people would come and visit, and we would offer them water, ice water. So it's all good now. It's all good.
Well, this opens up a lot of questions. I actually want to talk to you about the American Newspaper Repository, but before we get to that, it seems that you were really on the cutting edge of this in some way, because we're now living in a cultural moment with, you know, the Google books settlement and Google digitizing all these books, with things like the Kindle, which you wrote quite eloquently about this past summer in The New Yorker. And issues around things like the Kindle, say the, you know, Amazon deleting those Orwell books from users' Kindles when they found out that the seller didn't have the rights. All those kind of things raise an enormous number of questions. I think both challenges and exciting possibilities about where writing is going, how writing gets distributed, how it gets into readers' hands, and all of it's fraught in many ways, but not necessarily catastrophically. I'm curious about your thoughts on this and how they've evolved as you've been sort of working on these preservation ideas.
Well, I never thought that it was a bad idea to copy things. I mean, when we go into the gift shop in a great museum, we buy a postcard, and it's lovely because you have the postcard and you know that the original is on the wall. And in the case of copying anything, any book, any page, it can only add interest because each copy has its own quirks and oddities. And the Google Books project is a fantastic thing. And they actually are non-destructive in that they use a special machine that loses a little, I think it's a suction that sucks the page and then slowly slides it across. So they mechanically have reproduced these things. And there's really, I've used Google a lot in my own research, Google Books. It's a wonderful way of triangulating. You find out a couple of words or a reference, and then you go to the printed source, and then you go from there to maybe an old Fortune magazine from 1941, and you find things that you wouldn't have found. And any scholar who's working on any piece of the past has to thank Google Books for that incredible opportunity.
And they've done a great job with reproduction. I mean, the way the pages are readable, they're very clearly reproduced. They're user-friendly in the
yes.
best sense of the term.
Yes. So copying in itself is a great thing. And the Kindle, which is Amazon's reading device, is another form of making a copy. And I was excited about it. I have a trouble sometimes finishing books. I like to read in the middle of the night, and I have a problem, which is that I don't like to turn the light on because it, you know, wakes my wife up. And I knew that the Kindle didn't have backlighting, but I thought that I could buy this little clip-on light, and the clip-on light kept flopping off. And I felt that Amazon, which is a brilliant, wonderful company at selling things, was not so good at making the machine itself. It was gray background, and it had darker gray type. But my son helped me set up, buy an iPod Touch, and the iPod Touch allows you to read things that you've bought for your Kindle without actually touching a Kindle.
Right, and it's backlit. I agree with you, actually. I don't like reading on the Kindle. I love reading on the iPod Touch for some reason. And I have all these weird, you know, all this weird public domain stuff. You know, my kid's iPod Touch has, you know, 8 million songs on it. Mine has, you know, the Federalist Papers and the complete works of William Shakespeare.
Right. Well, I have a lot of songs on it too, but I also have this, there are some really nice little pieces of software. There's something called Eucalyptus by a guy who lives in Scotland, Jamie Robertson, I think it is, and he's for $9.99, you get 20,000 public domain books, but he's made them beautiful, and he's animated the page turn so that when you turn it, the page kind of has a whole physics, and it undulates, and if you only turn it halfway, the page will decide, no, you haven't turned me enough, and it'll fall back. It's something that adds beauty, you know, and the iPod Touch itself is a beautiful thing. It's about the width of a New Yorker column, and you can sit there and lie on your side and have this thing turned all the way down to the lowest point, you know, so that it's not pushing too many lumens into your eyeballs. And in the middle of the night, I think we want words just to flow in. We want big, sad, luminous words to come in, you know, and then you go to sleep.
It shuts off automatically.
And it shuts off automatically. It's so, and there's no sudden kind of desolate, frighteningly bright 60-watt bulb. There's just this little thing that, so in the middle of the night, I like electronic books a lot. During the day, mostly I read books on paper.
Now, one of the reasons I want to ask you is because in the new novel, in The Anthologist, you have, which is the story, for those of you who don't know, it's the first-person narration of a poet named Paul Chowder who is trying and failing to write the introduction to an anthology of rhyming verse that he has put together. He himself is not a rhyming poet, but he reveres rhyming verse all above other forms of verse. But he has a riff, Chowder does, and I don't mean to equate you with the character, but but I understand there are certain autobiographical connections here, where he says, you know, the English language may disappear in 300 years, but in 1,000 years, critics will be talking about, I'm phrasing this badly, the hair bump episode of the Mary Tyler Moore Show, an excellent episode, but that will be what survives rather than poetry. And it's funny, but it also feels to me that there's a kind of wistfulness or a sort of not exactly a pessimism, but a quality of something, and I wanted to ask you about that.
Well, right. I think, first of all, there's this great compliment that people paid each other in the 19th century. They would say that Macaulay would say that so-and-so's books, say, that Samuel Johnson's essays, will last as long as the language survives. And that always frightened me because I thought, well, how long is this language going to survive? I mean, Latin has become, it survives, but it's taught, it's a language that doesn't have that living flavor of spokenness. English will eventually go dead and crumbly. We don't know when. There's a sort of, in the book, the narrator calls it an Ozymandian feeling of to, when you say that something will last as long. It's terrifying, actually. How long is this great language of ours that we can all speak pretty well, and we fling these words out, and you understand them immediately, and there's no translation, and there's no graduate departments of English that will help you explain why it is that I'm using this shading of meaning. That's all going to go eventually. What is the original contribution that American culture has made to civilization? Is it the novel? I don't know. I think, you know, the sitcom is a beautiful, brilliant thing, and it's new. And maybe when in 300 years we'll be saying, isn't it sad that we don't know more about Marilyn McGowan Johnson, who wrote the Hair Bump episode of Mary Tyler Moore, or those people who worked on Larry Sanders? You know, those half hour, and they're not even half hour, those incredibly compressed 23-minute episodes are maybe the novels of our time. And yet, some of us still like lying in bed reading novels. So maybe you don't have to worry about it. Maybe we just want to do what we want to do and not think about what will perish and what won't.
Well, this book, I think, is a there are ways in which this book reminds me a little bit of You and I, even though that's a nonfiction book and this is a fiction book, in the sense that reading and the interaction of of a character, and I think that the I in You and I is sort of a, I mean, it's you, but it's a constructed you. The interaction of a character with text, with writers that character loves, a critical fiction, or in that case, a critical memoir, if you will. And I'm curious about that process, both whether your sense of, in writing those books, of how the act of being a reader infuses your writing, and how to write about it. It seems to be the intimate way that you write about reading seems to me to be perhaps the most difficult thing to get at in writing about reading. It's easy to sort of write with a critical distance, or easier.
Well, I think that You and I is a book, okay, that's about my interest back then and now, really. I wrote it in 1990, but about what you carry around about any writer. In this case, it was John Updike, but it could be anybody. The little phrases, the little things that you really love, the little biographical moments that you happen to know about this person. And what if you decide to write a book without preparing? Without saying, okay, it's a book about Updike, therefore I will read Updike from start to finish and then write the book. What if you decide I will write it and just use the residue, the working knowledge that's rattling around in my head? That's what I did. And you're right. That's in some ways very similar to what I tried to do in The Anthologist, although my character is a little bit fictional. He lives in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, and I live in South Berwick, Maine, about 20 minutes away. and his life situation is a little different in that he is, his girlfriend has left him and he's unhappy, and he doesn't have children. I have two children and a wife, but he has a barn, I have a barn. He has a white plastic chair, I have a white plastic. He has a badminton net, I have one. I mean, he has a dog. So there's just a huge overlap. Also,
you sing as you write, or you sing as you read as he does as well?
I went up in the barn as he did and sang for several weeks till I got hoarse, because when you really like a couple of lines. And this is the same thing as with the Updike book. You have these lines of poetry floating around in your head, all of us do, or pop songs that we really like. And they're there, and they're just, what can you say that's true about why we pay attention to this art form if you don't prepare, but just look within and find out what's in there? So I went up in the barn for several weeks, and I thought, well, this, I love this particular couplet. Often with a poem, and this was his, Paul Chowder's problem, is that he has to edit an anthology of poems, which means these are the ones I really love. And yet he finds that in all the poems that he really loves, there's really only a particular line or two lines that he really, really loves, and then there's a flawed line. So, you know, and there's a, they flee from me who sometime did me seek, and he loves that. And then he realizes, no, wait a minute. It's not just that he loves that line. He actually loves only a word in that line. Sometime. And he thinks of an anthology in which would be only single words taken from sometime. You know, that would be sometime, and then I think it's Sir Walter Raleigh who wrote that, you know. But what I wanted to do was go up there and say, how can I give something back to these lines of poetry that are in my head? And so I set them to music and sang them to myself. And then I thought, well, I've got them in my head. So as I was preparing the manuscript to send into the publisher, I wrote out those melodies because I felt that, you know, I'd done all this work in my barn. And also, it's trying to make the point that in some ways it's all that there's this very close joining between poetry and singing, that we think of the Elizabethan poets. Well, the Elizabethan poets sang their poems to lute music. I mean, this is a sung art form. Lyric means sung. So we have to reestablish that song lyric feeling. So if you have something like Dryden, all human things are subject to decay, and when fate summons, monarchs must obey, which is iambic pentameter. What are you going to do with it? I mean, if you like it, I like it. So I tried to go down, I up melodically different ways, and I ended up with a tune for it.
You talk about William Boyd, the Elizabethan William Boyd, not the current day novelist William Boyd, right? Who was the song who wrote those Elizabethan songs and used really almost entirely monosyllabic word choices. And you talk about sort of the first essay on poetry and the notion that poems should be stripped down to that bare essential, that there should be a minimum of multisyllabic words in a poem. I'm forgetting who wrote that essay, but it's a really interesting point.
Well, that's right. Right at the very beginning of English poetry, George Gascoigne said, you need to have as few words of many syllables as possible. And a lot of good poets learned that lesson, and they have these heavy single syllables that really, well, they flee from thee that sometime did me seek. The only second two-syllable word is sometime. So it's a good piece of advice, especially for somebody like me who grew up reading Thomas de Quincey and other 19th century heavily polysyllabic prose writers who go way too far in the other direction. I used to love the idea of Corinthian capitals and lots of applied ornament. And in this book, I wanted it to be more spoken. Mm-hmm. And because when I listen to poets, what I like best is when they describe how they came to write a poem. I was driving down Route 95, the coffee spilled in my lap, and I thought of a bird that I'd seen that morning. And I think, yeah, I love that story. I want to hear more about that. And then they read the poem, and it's fine. You know, it's okay. But I really liked the prologue.
So is this book then Chowder's introduction? The whole book is, you know, involves this writing of the introduction. And I won't say what happens at the end, but I'm wondering, is this book in some way, you know, the metafiction that this is Chowder's introduction?
Well, I mean, it's he says it's 230 pages long. And
that was the part I wasn't going to give away.
Well, you know, it's not, it's not. I don't think there's an exact correspondence because the editor says we'll have to make some cuts. Right. But this is maybe, I hope that this is the poem that he wishes that he could have written, that he's not sure that he will ever write, but here's something in prose that has, what I think is interesting is having characters sit somewhere in a chair usually, and they think about big things, but they are surrounded by their own life, and maybe an inchworm falls on their hand as they're typing, or maybe they have a cut, or maybe they see somebody walking by picking up trash and putting it in a plastic trash bag. But something happens at the same time they're thinking about these gigantic questions like, is poetry worthwhile? Or what is the future of verse or something like that? I like the specific circumstances surrounding the big questions, because otherwise the big questions just feel so vague that I can't focus on them properly.
Well, and also I think what's interesting here, too, is that I was going to ask you if you wanted to read something that would illustrate that point. but I also think that there's, not to put you on the spot or anything, but I also think it's interesting the way that you sort of take this big idea of poetry and make it very accessible. You know, you bring in Ludacris, you bring in contemporary hip-hop lyrics and talk about how all of this is rhyming poetry, that we listen to rhyming poetry all the time, mm-hmm. And that there's a direct lineage between, say, Dryden and Vachel Lindsay and a rapper like Ludacris.
Well, a rapper like Ludacris. Shake your money maker like somebody's about to pay you. I'm just reading off because I can't remember it. Don't worry about them haters. Keep your nose up in the aya. I love paya and aya. It's a beautiful rhyme. Hip-hop uses this pulsing four-beat thing. 1, 2, 3, 4. 2, 2, 3, 4. 3, 2, 3, 4. 4, 2, 3, 4. Which is, you know, just one of the several sub-varieties of four-pulse rhythm, which is, I think, the soul of English poetry. And I was pleased to quote Poe on the same page, because Poe's Raven has the same sort of pulsing thing. It's slower, but in the silken, sad, uncertain rustling of each purple curtain, thrilled me, chilled me with fantastic terrors never felt before. That's a ballad rhythm. It's four beats, and there are four lines per stanza. And yet, metrical analysis has this very elaborate vocabulary for it. So they talk about Poe's Raven having, here's one, trochaic octameter with lines 2 and 4 catalectic, which means cut short. And that's true. But what you're really talking about is this kind of taking a walk rhythm that's a ballad. And it's absolutely the same kind of taking a walk rhythm as A.A. Milne. Here's another one with these four beats. And I love these four beat ones because they can be kind of comic. Like, let's see, if you stick a stock of liquor in your locker, rest. It is slick to stick a lock upon your stock, rest. Or some joker who is slicker is going to trick you of your liquor. Though you snicker, you'll feel sicker from the shock, rest. You know, that's a four lines with four beats, and the rests are beats. That's crucial. So you can do the comic stuff, or you can do this kind of Poe, lush, slow, pulsing stuff. But that wasn't what we were talking about, is it?
Well, no, it was. But I guess I was wondering, do you want to read a little bit to give a taste of sort of...
Okay, so this guy, Paul Chowder, it's hard to hold it all in your head, he says. All the different possible ways that you can enjoy life or not enjoy life, and all the things that are going on, the different rug patterns, the different car designs, the different radio shows that are coming and going, the new ads, the new crop of famous people. And then there is, of course, always and inevitably, this spume of poetry that's just blowing out of the flue holes of the earth, just masses of poetry. It's unstoppable. It's uncorkable. There's no way to make it end. If we could just stop for 1 year. If everybody could just stop publishing their poems. No more. Every poet, just stop. But of course, that's totally unfair to the poets who are just starting out. This may be their Wunderjahr. This may be the years that they really find their voice. And I'm telling them to stop? No, that wouldn't do. But wouldn't it be great? To have a moment to regroup and understand? I'm talking with a man who gets, is it 700 books a week?
Something like that, yeah.
Come into the Los Angeles Times. I mean, that's really frightening. Everybody would ask, okie doke, what new poems am I going to read today? Sorry, none. There are no new poems. And so you're thrown back onto what's already there. And you look at what's on your own shelves that you bought maybe 8 or 10 years ago, and you think, have I really looked at this book? This book might have something in it. And it's there. It's been waiting and waiting without any demonstration or clamor. No squeaky wheel. It's just been waiting. If everybody was silent for a year, wouldn't we all be better people? I think probably so. I think that the lack of poetry, the absence of poetry, the yearning to have something new would be the best thing that could happen to our art. No poems for a solid year, maybe two. For instance, here's a recent New Yorker. Actually, no, it was published almost 6 years ago. I got it from my pile. Pretty cover as always, or almost always. There have been some lapses, yes. But this is what I mean. You lift it, you hold it, you flap it, and week after week, year after year, you hold it and you flap it. And say you open it up and flip through looking for the two new poems, and no, there would be no poem on page 67 and no poem on page 83. They just simply wouldn't be there. Let's have a look at this poem. Here it is. Going down. You can tell it's a poem because it's swimming in a little gel pack of white space. That shows that it's a poem. All the typography on all sides is drawn back. The words are making room. They're saying, rumble, rumble, stand back now. This is going to be good. Here the magician will do his thing. Here's the guy who's going to eat razor blades or pour gasoline in his mouth and spout it out or lie on a bed of broken glass. So, stand back, you crowded onlookers of prose. This is not prose. This is the blank white playing field of Eton. And you can read it for yourself on page 67 of this New Yorker. Alice Quinn. The magnificent Alice. This was back in the day when Alice was the poetry editor. God bless that hardworking, cheerful, nice woman. She left recently, and now it's Paul Muldoon, and I hardly know Paul Muldoon. And really, I hardly knew Alice Quinn, to be honest. But at least she actually accepted some of my own poems. Thank you, Alice. And rejected some of them. Damn her! Things that just hurt me to have them come back saying, this isn't for us. This one didn't quite work for us, but we're glad to have something from you. We're glad. The crafting of these kind no-thank-you letters. I assume Paul Muldoon will do it well, too. The really good editors have the gift, and they hurt so bad when they're nice. You get a turn down, and then you flip through the magazine, and you say, why? Why did Alice accept this firkin of flaccidness here on page 114 and not one of my poems? Why? Etc.
Well, actually, I think that's a great passage that kind of really captures the voice, but it also gets at this thing that I'm really interested in about a lot of your work, which is this tendency to sort of, I don't mean it in a slight way, but in an important way, the tendency towards digression and towards a kind of fascination with ephemera, whether the ephemera be, in this instance, the actual name of the former and current poetry editor of the New Yorker, mm-hmm. so that there's no, even though it's a work of fiction, there's no fictional filter there, mm-hmm. Or other things, the kind of the details in the mezzanine that build up to a complete narrative when it's really about a man on his lunch hour, or this book, which is really about a man trying to write something he's having trouble writing with a bunch of other things factored in. It builds out of that, and it builds out of these kind of digressive stories, sort of like what you were saying about what interests you about hearing poets read. You're more interested in the digressive story that leads up to the poem rather than the poem itself.
Well, yes, I like to have a lot of a very busy surrounding of detail that's around the thing that I'm getting at. I remember trying to think of how I could say that I loved my girlfriend. I mean, this was in the mezzanine, and of course I had an image, the person that I was married to, you want to say something true about being in love with somebody. Well, how do you do that? If you approach it head on, you just use these words that don't actually have any import. And so I had to write about the fact that, and this is true. I mean, what am I going to say? She didn't like the fact that I used these earplugs at night, and so she used the toaster tongs to lift the earplugs, and that was revolting but also interesting to me. So I put that in because I said that they were Mac earplugs. They were Mac silicone earplugs, and I talked about the specifics because it just somehow comforted me to have all of that nailed down in one page. I don't know. I always think that when I read Boswell's Johnson and they talk about the particular kind of... Actually, there's a passage in Boswell's Johnson where he says, what we want to know about Milton is everything. We want to know even about the fact that he had a certain kind of buckle on his shoes, you know, and I think that's true. We want to know what life was like at a certain time, which means what the shoes felt like, what the doorknobs felt like, what the earplugs felt like, and yeah.
But I was going to say, but in the case of someone like Milton, it's always struck me that the reason we want to know those things is because it's the... those small particulars, that's the only way we're going to be able to imagine ourselves into that genius, because he seems so beyond us, certainly beyond me, in any way that I can ascertain. Whereas in your books, it's actually the kind of, to steal a phrase from DJ Waldie, or the sacred ordinariness of all of these details, because they're characters who we can imagine. You know, I think that Paul's a very sort of accessible character in a lot of ways, you know, self-critical, flawed, trying to muddle his way through this thing, whatever it is that we're all in. And so those particulars just sort of root us further in that quality of him.
But yes, it's not that I'm saying that that I'm doing this because people will be studying my work like John Milton's work, because there's just no... We have no overlap whatsoever.
You're more fun to read.
You know, I want to say something about enjambment, if I may. Because John Milton really had a problem with that, and he did it too much. And it's blank verse, and you can call it blank verse all you want, but there is something about iambic pentameter that is important and there's a secret to it. And the secret is this last missing beat. And in a strange way, I think that Milton was a guy with a brilliant mind and not much of an ear. And I'm ashamed and embarrassed to say that, but I think it's true. Somebody like Dryden, who came afterwards, or Pope, any number of people, or Shakespeare before him, would hear that time of year thou mayst in me behold, that's five, rest. Or Dryden, all human things are subject to decay. Rest. The rest is there. We all know it's there. We hear it's there. All human things are subject to decay. Rest. And when fate summons, monarchs must obey. Rest. The poets who decided they were going to be iambic pentameter writers, but they were not going to pay attention to this rest, write this stuff that's very rich and sometimes beautiful, but is out of sync with itself. And you can hear it when you read new formalist writers who are trying to follow the old rules, but they don't hear the old rules with their toe. You know, they don't tap their feet to the old rules. They just follow them as marks on the page. They get out of sync with themselves. So, and it's as if they were saying, "True wit is nature to advantage dressed. What oft was thought, but ne'er so well expressed." You know, they're getting off track. So I wanted in this book, although this is about a fictional character and he's got all of his problems, and I wanted there to be some real observed truth about poetry behind what he was saying. I wanted my little crank theories to get out. So I put them in a fictional character.
Now, this book follows what I think is maybe your most controversial book, Human Smoke. Mm-hmm. And I think in many ways another misunderstood book. But it's also a book that builds out of ephemera, out of an accretion of small fragmentary details. You've described it, I think, as wanting to give us as contemporary readers a sense of what it would have been like to be reading about the history of, or reading about World War II or the build-up to World War II as it was happening in newspapers, and it's written in those kind of chunks. I wanted to ask you about that impulse to build that sort of big history, the history of that huge century-changing event through that most minuscule of levels.
Well, right. I wanted to write a book about World War II because I didn't understand it, and I wasn't a professional historian, and I was in the midst of writing actually a book about the history of the Library of Congress in World War II, because they were sort of the incubator of the Office of Strategic Services. There were hundreds of people working for the Office of Strategic Services, which was the precursor to the CIA, in this floor of the annex of the Library of Congress. So I was working on this kind of institutional history and realized I didn't know what the war was really all about. And the way I tried to learn about it was, in a sense, to stay on the surface and ask at every moment, what about these guys sitting around this table making this decision in London in 1940? Is this the decision that anyone in this room would make? Let's pull this thing out of context, in a sense. Let's say this is a piece of the past, and look at it in isolation. Here are these guys, and they're talking about how to fight against this horrible, completely terrifying power coming from Germany. And they decide that one way to do it is to set fire to the forests of Germany. Another way is to have a very long, slow war that will starve Germany and Central Europe into submission. I wanted the reader, as he was reading this or she was reading this, to ask, does that make any sense? No, it doesn't make sense. To me, it doesn't make sense. It wasn't the right way to resist this unprecedentedly evil and frightening power. And what I found in working on the book was something that I think made a lot of people really mad, which is, and I'll just say it, I mean, who were the people who actually wanted to open the borders to the oppressed minorities of Europe in advance of the war? They were the pacifists. There was an absolute one-to-one correspondence between the people who actually wanted to save and help those people most at risk and the people who didn't think that wars were going to get you where you wanted to go. That was, I think, the fundamental discovery that I made over and over again. A man sat in front of a congressional committee and said, the Jews of Europe stand more chance of finding a way to safety at the negotiating table with the United States and England as their champions than they do on the battlefield. That's a powerful, powerful thing that he said. And we know how things turned out with an extremely long war that had this kind of war of attrition, city bombing. We know that it worked out horribly. So the book was an attempt to ask the question whether it doesn't make it, whether it doesn't in fact make sense to say in some basic fundamental way that the pacifists were right. And that made a lot of people angry, but I think it's actually worth considering.
Do you think that part of the reaction had to do with, and maybe part of the impetus, whether consciously or otherwise, had to do with the culture that the book was being published in, sort of right at the pretty much the tail end of the utter collapse of the Bush Doctrine and the, in an American mm-hmm. culture that seemed utterly morally bankrupt on a variety of levels, among them militaristically?
Well, sure, because I was a person who said, like a lot of people, you know, this is don't attack Iraq, don't drop bombs, don't do all those things. I resisted the war. I realized that, and I even wrote this book that was complicated, in which a guy was a little bit addled and insisted that the right way to solve all the problems was to assassinate the president, and his longtime friend who kind of understood that he was addled talks him out of it. So there's this disturbing book that I wrote. And I realized at some point that you can write op-ed pieces and you can write things in Slate saying, don't attack Iraq. But unless you actually look at the arguments for war and against war, you're never going to get anywhere. And the basic argument is there are wars, and most of them are bad, but then there's some wars that have a special reason for being, and those are called just wars. And those just wars are sort of enveloped in an enamel of uncriticizability. And World War II is one of those wars. And what you have to do in order to think about it rationally as a feeling human being is to crack open that enamel and ask, was it in fact a just war? Was the way that the West resisted the Hitlerian menace something that actually helped anybody who was in trouble? And so, yes, if it was absolutely or partially a response to the fact that it didn't seem like any of the other ways of arguing against the current war were working. And what we had to do was kick the props out of the good war, because that was the one that was, in a way, supporting all this elaborate and absurd structure of other wars.
Well, now, Human Smoke and Checkpoint, which is the novel you're talking about the man who was plotting to assassinate the president, are your most, maybe even the only really overtly political writing you've done. And I'm curious about that from the point of view of you as a writer. What are the, you know, especially going back to this, which is a much different kind of book, what are the challenges and the difficulties, the frustrations or the exhilarations of writing overtly politically? Do you see another instance where you'd write another very political book?
I think it's terribly challenging. And it's also symptomatic of the fact that wars are just not good for one's ability to concentrate and think about gentleness, and it pushes everyone to a more extreme side. It makes everyone a little more violent than they would actually be. I mean, I look at Checkpoint now, and I think that's really a very strange way to have talked about all that. But what I was thinking of at the time was, here is this justification for a violent act. We must take out Saddam Hussein because if we do this, if we assassinate these particular people, the world will be a better place. That's the argument. So I have my troubled person use that same argument, but use it against our own president. And it horrifies this guy who I identify with, who says, what? You know, this don't do this. It's basically the whole novel is, I want to do this, don't do this. And then the ending is that he doesn't do it. So I've given it away. You don't have to read it. But having done that and done the human smoke, I think, what do you do if any of you here were able to solve all the world's problem, you would get it up to a zero point. And then we'd all stand around in this happy zero point and say, where's the poetry? You know, where's the beauty? Come on, let's see some paintings. Let's. So in some ways, then you have to then think, well, what is it about life that is actually worth living once you pull things up to the point where people aren't being, killed by drone planes and wedding parties aren't being killed. And this continues, by the way. I mean, this is the uncriticizability of the Obama administration is unfortunate because we're still flying remote-controlled drone planes all over there, and it's wrong. And it's just as wrong as when, you know, the right was doing it.
Well, and also sinking deeper and deeper into Afghanistan, which without any sense of what history has taught about those kind of engagements in that kind of region. Yeah. I'm curious about this, but to me, I guess what's interesting about these books is that they pose difficult and complicated questions. They ask us to look at things in a difficult, complicated way. By, say, in the case of Checkpoint, by proposing the unthinkable and then having a discussion about or debate about it. In the case of Human Smoke, asking us to rethink World War II, not in the simplistic way that I think a lot of critics of the book talked about by saying it was equating FDR with Hitler, but rather by saying that things are much more complicated and nuanced than we think they are. There are a lot of things that factor in and a lot of image that isn't, you know, that things are more three-dimensional. And that, to me, it connects to the way, in a much different sense, a book like The Mezzanine or The Anthologist works, that what all of these books are about is sort of what you said to Susan and what Louise quoted you saying, is that, you know, a human being can think about a lot of things and to go a little further, think about them deeply and in complicated ways. So I just wanted to close and then turn it over to some questions from the audience just by asking your thoughts on that idea. I mean, it seems that looked at one way, your body of work is immensely diverse and all over the place, and in another way, immensely consistent and very kind of focused.
Well, it's very nice of you to say that. It doesn't, on any given day, I don't know whether it's focused or not, but I wrote a book about two people talking on the phone, and they're supposedly having phone sex, but what they're doing is trying to become real to each other, and they take over each other's stories. And I like to have things have a kind of deliberate but random feeling, so that you're going here, but then you're pulled over here. And in The Anthologist, this man has his theories and he wants to get to them, but he's distracted because, you know, he hurts his finger when he runs, when he misses the last step on the stairs, or he goes down to the creek and sees all these things of pollen going by, and he's distracted. The distractibleness, the distractingness of the world is one of the beautiful things about the world. In Human Smoke, I just allowed myself to be distracted by the fact that the front pages of American newspapers of that era have an incredible wealth of detail about what actually happened in the war. They have all sorts of warning notes from Japan saying, don't provoke, and moments of protest from people who were quite reasonable and rational saying, this is not necessarily the way to do it. If you cordon off Japan this way and shut off their assets, they're going to attack. And finding these things and allowing yourself to be distracted by them is one way of, I guess I feel, filling in the empty places on the page and allowing the little green shoots to pop up among the pavers or something. And so it all sounds like it's part of a grand plan, but actually it's just what feels like fun to write that day, you know. So,
well, thank you very much.
Thank you for your questions.
We have We have the man with the microphone. So raise your hand, and there's a guy right there.
I was thinking about when I read Fermata and came to that long, sexually explicit section, and
written a long time ago.
And I remember my mind sort of part of my mind began to compare it to pornography I had read, actual pornography, and then I began to have a fantasy idea of you arguing your case to the publisher about why this needed to happen, and I just wanted to ask you about that kind of subject, about whether there was a debate, and about because it still seems to me to be the most sexually explicit mainstream novel stuff I've ever read, and I think it's I'm interested.
It felt fairly explicit at the time, and it was, of course, it was intoxicatingly exciting to write. The idea of this book is that a guy can push up his glasses or do something with his watch or click a pen and the world stops. And this was before The Matrix. It was before Bullet Time. It was before Click, you know, with Adam Sandler. It was, however, not before the Star Trek episode where they drink diamond juice and the whole, and they can go suddenly go so fast that the rest of the world seems stopped. But in any case, this was my own. I mean, I'm not that ashamed to say, or a little bit ashamed, but also urgently, confessionally motivated to say that this was my own adolescent fantasy. I thought, wouldn't it be great to have a black box with a toggle switch on it and a red light? And that the world would be going along, and you'd flip the toggle switch, and the world would stop, and you could do anything you wanted. And then I thought, well, what would I want to do? Well, I'd want to take... Actually, at that point, I thought, I just want to look at women. I just want to look at them. Really look at them without embarrassing them and without embarrassing myself, because I was shy. And then, you know, a few months went by, I'd want to take off women's clothes, you know? So that was my adolescent fantasy. And it seemed at some point that it was worth devoting a whole novel to that, and that's what happened. And the publisher, the publisher read it and said, "We're going to publish it right away." There was no arguing. Yes, that's your next book. So it was okay. I had, and the publisher, my editor then is my publisher now. And he's a very tolerant and brilliant guy named David Rosenthal, and he's always just sort of published the things that I wanted to write. So I've been very lucky. I've had other editors too, but he's sort of been the center of my writing.
Other questions?
And a brave man, I should say, because some of the books were difficult for him to publish, I think.
I know you said that earlier, I heard you say you made up a little bit of the information that seems like it's scholarly information in the book. Maybe a little history of the word enjambment.
Mm-hmm.
So how much of the book can we read like we're really reading a poetry professor's information about poetry, or do we need to be on the lookout for stuff that might not be accurate?
Okay, if my narrator says, here's the deal about enjambment, it comes from the French word jambon, which means ham, and the reason is because back in the time of Ronsard, when they had one line run into the next, they hated it so much that one guy would pick up a ham and fling it at the other guy. You know that that's made up. That's made up. But I really do want most of the things in here, because I worked hard to get them right, I wanted them to be true. So I'm hoping that there's a fair underlayment of our subfloor of real fact in the book. When I say that Louise Bogan and Theodore Redke had this lost weekend together, which they did, and that she bloomed like a Persian rose bush, you know. She did. She said that in a letter. And she wrote the most beautiful letter about writing a poem and getting paid $7.50 for it by the New Yorker. And she wrote what she spent that money on: soap, a bottle of whiskey, and a book, and a pen. Four things. And that's all true. So when I mention these, that kind of thing, I mean it all to be true, because I tried to make it as true as I could. I hope that it's clear when I'm stretching or joking or something.
When you began writing, even though you may have primarily been following your own train of thought, you must have done a good deal of research. By now, you've got the internet, and there's no end to the research you can do. Do you consciously draw a line at some point and say, that's enough, or is it a more aesthetic satisfaction, that's enough, I understand this well enough?
That's true. When I first started writing, it was a different experience to seek out the hidden places. I mean, what scholars really want to do is find the hidden stuff, uncover it. And there was a lot more that was covered because it was in the library, it was slumbering there, and now you can make these incredible discoveries by searching for keywords and things. But there's always stuff that isn't known. I mean, there's always this urge, at least, on the part of scholars to find the things that people don't know. And I love learning new things. And I mean, we have an infinitude of stuff out there, but it all has to be processed and thought and then paid out in linear sentences, made sense of, sorted, filtered. So it still feels like the same activity. Is that true for you, David?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's... You've got the overload, and then it requires more filtering, but you can find all kinds of things, you know? Yeah. It was amazing when I was... We were just in Brooklyn, not together, but together. I mean, we both were in Brooklyn for the same thing, but we weren't doing anything. But to do research for a panel that I was on, using Google, I found all kinds of stuff that I would have taken me months to find, and I found it all, you know, in 20 minutes while I was cramming for the panel.
And I wrote a piece for the New York Review of Books on Wikipedia because I love it, and it's great, and it's a tremendous, almost miraculous collaborative effort, and yet it's so messy, and there are these strange things where the Pop-Tart page is always being vandalized. And you know, one of the fascinating things is to watch a Wikipedia article on something and see that bits of the 1911 Encyclopedia Britannica, the original thing that they used because it was out of copyright to start the original Wikipedia article, still survive, like these bits of broken stone that have been incorporated into a Renaissance wall. And I love the fact that there are all these new human innovations that nonetheless have to kind of make sense of and use the things that are coming down from older efforts, older encyclopedias. And I think that scholars always want to find unknown things, and they always will be searching for those, and there always will be unknown things that are waiting to be found.
First, thank you for your writing. You've given me and friends so many hours of pleasure.
Thank you.
What, for you, has been the most pleasurable books to write, and conversely, which have been the most difficult?
What have been the most pleasurable books to write? Well, I worked on Wall Street, and I rode the escalator to this mezzanine level where I was an oil industry analyst. And I loved riding the escalator. And I made lots of notes about that. And I had a complicated plot about Wall Street that I thought was important to include. And I was very unhappy because I couldn't write it. But I also had things that I'd like to do on my lunch hour. I would burst out of that revolving door, and it was a sunlit Wall Street afternoon, and there were hot dog vendors and a popcorn guy, and I went to go get shoelaces. And that was the exciting, beautiful moment for me. So the exciting thing, or the moment of joy, was when I could get rid of the big Wall Street plot and just write about what I actually wanted to read about, which was, you know. So there was a kind of lyrical high in writing the mezzanine that I think lots of writers maybe say that the first time you actually get to page, I don't know, 47 or 58 of a book, and you realize you're way into a book and that you could almost die and it would be partly done. That's an exciting moment, you know. And then I was another moment when I was, the draft was done and I had marks all over it, and my infant daughter was sleeping in the car, and I sat on the grass and went through it and thought, well, it's, you know. So that was the most, probably finishing the first book was gave me the most pleasure, in the sense of just sheer relief that I had a book to show for all those years as a office worker. After Wall Street, I was a temp for many years and took lots of notes. And they were all coming into a single book. Other books have been, you know, it's been fun to write since then, but not that sense of just relief. I've not felt that since. What about you? When was the...
Actually, my feeling was after the... it was, now I've done this and I never have to do it again.
Yeah.
But I agree. There's a great Annie Dillard line I always think about, which is that, you know, at a certain point you get far enough in where you're too far to go back. Yeah. And it's at that point that you realize the fatal structural flaw in what you're doing. Yeah. And from that, and it just becomes a matter of shoring up the sinking house.
It's true. I remember there's Robert De Niro in Midnight Run. He's trying to catch the guy, and he says at the end, "I've come too far," and that's the feeling you get. You're certain you're right on the edge. You're about, I don't know, 4/5 of the way done, and there's just nothing more urgent than to get to the end of that book, finish it.
It always reminds me of the guy in The Plague, where there's that writer in Camus' The Plague, where he just keeps writing and rewriting the first sentence of the book because he's sure if he gets the first sentence perfect, then the rest of the book will just fall into place.
Right, and he is so wrong. You can get the first sentence perfect, and you're nowhere. You know, you have to go further.
Right. I think we have one question right up here.
Thanks. I've always been really interested in yours or your alter ego's almost fetishistic relationship to objects, and so we know you collect words on paper, but do you personally collect, or what's your current kind of relationship to objects?
To objects? What's my relationship to objects? I fantasize about being a collector, in that I in fact, one box of matches, one novel, the guy says, "Oh, wouldn't it be great to have been a collector of paper towel patterns?" And you could, you know, you'd have the paper towel patterns from the 70s and the 80s, and you'd see when they went into two colors and four colors, and you'd have the memorial, you know, his name was Emmett, the Emmett paper towel collection. But I am not a very methodical person. I'm a messy person. So my relationship with objects is that even though I love them and I my office is cluttered with stuff, I'm not able to codify and catalog and keep track of things the way I should. As far as collecting words and sentences, that it deserves a word in itself, because it helped me learn how to write, which is that I thought, as I was reading, I read about the keeping of commonplace books, and as I was reading something that I liked, I would put a little dot in the margin, a little tiny dot, and go back later and copy out that passage. And I found it was kind of like collecting, in that you copy it out, but what you do is you become the amanuensis or the apprentice to that particular two-sentence passage. And it's so beautiful, because every word, the interest, the complexity and the strangeness of the passage starts to work and starts to speak to you in a different way because you've slowed down to the point of handwriting. If you type it, it's too easy. If you say it to yourself, it's too easy. But if you have to handwrite it, you become the slave to some other writer. And it actually teaches you a great deal about different kinds of prose styles and the way writers make exceptions to these kinds of rules that we think of as are desperately important, like which versus that. Forget it. Which versus that? Every great writer that you can possibly say in this room, from Dickens to Trollope to everyone, used which the wrong way. So go ahead and use it. You know, you'll find that if you copy them out.
And we have time for one more question. This woman right up here.
Not a question, really, but you are as delicious to listen to as you are to read.
I'm embarrassed. I'm beaming. I'm blushing. No.
The congruence of your voice on the page with your voice in the ear is something very rare and wonderful.
Oh.
And so I am hoping that you have had, if you have not already had, that you will have before you leave an opportunity to ride in the elevator of this building, where you will encounter the work of an amazing artist named David Bunn, who said that the best day of his life was when he showed up on the day that the Los Angeles Public Library was disposing of its card catalog. Oh. And he made a work in the elevator shaft of pages from the card catalog, and he's gone on to make an amazing body of work writing poems from the card catalogs that are framed and are works of art, and I think of all the time as a tribute to you.
Well, I will look forward to that ride in the elevator very much. Thank you very much for saying those things.
Thank you all for coming. Thank you to Nicholson Baker.
Thank you, David.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the Annenberg Foundation, City National Bank, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KUSC 91.5 FM and KCET. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.